Mahatji, and it's the last. It's a very important, probe that we'll talk about now, which is called the cosmic microwave background, so the CMB from now on. And I'm sure you heard of it, but I will try to review qualitatively the physics underlying it, and also give you a status of observations and where we are going. So I'll cover a bit briefly the original CMB spectrum, its history. I will talk about the WMAP satellite, yeah. You might have heard of. Hope you have. I'll talk about the CMB power spectrum. I'll discuss qualitatively the main features between the first peak, and then I'll talk about polarization. Okay? So, basically, as we, as you know from the Big Bang, the standard Big Bang model, the universe started, you know, if you go back in time, the universe got denser and denser, so hotter and hotter. And if you go, as we, actually, if you go far enough, let's say, so before recombination, the universe was fully ionized. Atoms didn't form, so it was just protons, photons, and neutrons, okay? And that's before recombinations. And basically, and as we discussed yesterday, when we discussed VAO, up to this point, the universe was, because photons and baryons were tightly coupled, the universe was totally opaque, right? And so it doesn't mean the mean free path of photons was very, very small, okay? Much, much smaller than the horizon. When the universe became cold enough so that the first atoms formed, okay, so suddenly the universe became neutral, and so you had no interaction anymore between photons and matter, and suddenly the photons decoupled, okay, so the mean free path dramatically increased, reached the horizon, and that's a time we call recombination, and this is where the CMB was emitted. And so the CMB is basically the light we observe today, which comes from this decoupling epoch. Okay, and when did that happen? Basically, this happened. Current estimate is like 400,000 years, or between 300 and 400,000 years after the Big Bang. Okay, and so to give you, and as you know, my current estimate gives for the age of the universe about 13.7 giga years. Okay, so it's like this. It was really early on, because of the reason I just mentioned. The universe was totally opaque before, so that basically the CMB would be the oldest light we can observe. So it's the oldest probe we can have in the early universe. So there are that's what makes it very special and very unique. Okay, so we heard from Alessandra the other day, we might be able to look for another window into the early universe, and maybe to even earlier time with these gravitational waves. Okay, some simple gravitational waves can. You can probe directly the importance of inflation, but if you talk about electromagnetic physics, then the CMB would be the oldest light you can think of. Okay, so why is it microwave? Basically, from basically basic physics, which is like the energy binding of a hydrogen atom, you know exactly, you know at which temperature, if you work out the thermal history of the universe precisely, you know at which temperature the recombination must have occurred. So it gives you the age, gives you the temperature for the and the spectrum. And if you have the temperature, everything is in equilibrium, so it gives you the wavelength of the light then. So the light then is basically about a micron, so it's fully, it's visible light. So if you were living at this time, you would see, you know, glow of light, it would be fully visible. But as we know, the universe is expanding, as it expands, you know, light gets redshifted, and so about recombination is basically when the universe was about 300,000 years old, which is a redshift. If you put that in terms of redshift, it's about 1,000, so you get a factor of 1,000 stretch into your wavelength, and so millimeter, micrometers become millimeter, and this becomes centimeter, millimeter wavelengths. Okay, so why it's microwave. Okay, so the way it was discovered by Penzias and Wilson in 1964, and they got the Nobel Prize for that. Using this very impressive antenna, and they were used, they were looking for, obviously they were not looking for the CMB then, they were looking for other radio signal, but when they were trying to map, to look for this special celestial object, they noticed that they had some background noise they couldn't explain, and this background noise was independent of position, and the later on it was interpreted at the CMB. Okay, and so it was a fortuitous discovery, but it would have been discovered anyhow because other groups like Deakin, and most notably Deakin collaborator in Princeton were cosmologists and were actually actively looking for the signal. So those guys discovered it, and the Princeton group like providing them with the interpretation. But the Princeton group was also developing its own instrument to look for that. So it really happened together. But if you look at I'm sure you heard of that, the density of photons, of CMB photons today, okay, so basically photons that were emitted at the time of recombination, is about 400 photons per cubic centimeter. Okay, so it's not fully negligible. And if you look at, if you look at your TV untuned, if you look at channel 69, which is, 800 megahertz, so, you don't have broadcasting here, you just have snow on the screen, and of the snow, about 10% of the power comes from actually CMB. Okay, so you have seen CMB already in your life, which when you were watching, and then probably days late at night watching TV, you've seen CMB and other things. Okay, so the history of the CMB, dates for the CMB, basically 1965, yes, right, 65, discovery of this uniform radiation all over the sky. Okay, that's a discovery of CMB. Second stage was COBE 1992. So we see this constant across the sky, the monopole, and basically the underlying picture that you know already, I'm sure, is basically what you see in the CMB. So you will see what's happening is that if you look around us, like if you look at the low redshift universe, it's highly inhomogeneous, right? You see galaxies, you see clusters of galaxies, you see filaments, all those things I mentioned before. So it's highly inhomogeneous. So we see that all this formed by gravitational instability, plus baryonic physics, but mostly gravitational instability. And so if you go back in time, you should still see seeds of this object, of this perturbation that grew in time to form the structures. And basically, given the structure we see today, if our interpretation is correct, you should see in a CMB perturbation in a temperature. Okay, you should see the seed of this. On this perturbation at a much lower amplitude. So that's what really, once we were convinced that the CMB existed, what really motivated people to look for more better observation is really to look at this inhomogeneity or anisotropy in the CMB temperature. And it was, a lot of ground-based experiments tried to do it. Some did, but it was pretty controversial, till the COBE satellite, which was launched in 1992, produce this map from the first time you were able to see large scale, anisotropy of the CMB. And basically, to do that, you have to remove the monopole to the average. If you observe the sky, you remove the mean, that's what you will see. Okay. That was a big, that was a huge, of course, breakthrough. And this became one of the pillar of, modern cosmology. So, and it was predicted way before than observed. And it became really uncontroversial because there's no other way to provide this kind of radiation with this kind of statistical properties. So after that, people got more and more excited about the CMB, and people realized that it was really a golden mine for cosmological information. And so better instruments were built, better satellites, and the most accomplished so far is a double image satellite, which produced, improved greatly over COBE by a factor of, more than 2 orders of magnitude in sensitivity and resolution. Okay, and so basically, part of the team that did COBE went to double image. And so this is WMAP is still flying, still collecting data. We have had results. And now there is actually a new satellite which I haven't put here, which was just launched like 2 months ago. Okay, which is a Planck satellite, and I'll talk a little more about that. Which will again be an order magnitude improvement over WMAP. Okay, so bigger ground base and satellite, and there are also those are the big milestones. But there are also people are competing with ground-based experiments, which are, of course, more technologically advanced because it's easier to build an experiment on the ground than to build it in space. And so there are also parallel efforts on the ground using interferometers or using digital instruments. So the universe is in equilibrium then, and so if you it's in equilibrium with some till recombinations. If you compute the temperature, you expect, given the some other story of the universe, you expect today to see a perfect black body with temperature of about 2 Kelvin, a little less than 3. And from what you observe, if you observe this radiation today, you can measure it. You can look at its spectra. You can infer you can infer its temperature, and so you can get the temperature of recombination. From that, you can get the redshift of recombinations. And here's a spectacular curve produced by the COBE instrument, where you have this perfect black body curve. Okay, here on this curve, it includes error bars. Okay, and this is average over the sky. So the error bars are everywhere smaller than the thickness of the curve. So this actually is the best measured black body in physics, okay, which is a CMB, that's the best measurement of the black body spectra. So it's extremely impressive. And this was measured by a spectrometer, the FIRAS instrument within a COBE satellite. Okay, so it's quite an accomplishment. And actually, so they got the Nobel Prize for this and Alan's probably like 2 years ago. So but it's a huge deal. If you look at the residuals, to look at the error bars of residual in terms of temperature between the black body and the perfect black body temperature, you open this curve and you see the error bars. But again, very, very good agreement. Okay, so this is most of the uncertainties here come from the in order to make this measurement, you need to calibrate in each frequency, you need to calibrate over some reference black body within the satellite. And most of the uncertainty in this measurement comes from the uncertainty in the black body that we're able to generate within the satellite. So it's really, really a perfect black body. All right. So I'll mention the next satellite that was dedicated after COBE to measure CMB. It's called double image satellite. So it has two mirrors. It's symmetric. You have a symmetry plane here, and it's rotating all the time around it. There's a spin axis, and then the spin axis is rotating. And basically, what WMAP is measuring your, two telescopes, one here, one here, and at any given time, it's measuring the difference between these two sides. And this is like to limit systematics, to remove the monopole, and to remove all kind of thermal drifts. Okay, so it's for systematic control. It was launched 2001. Pretty nice picture. Just cool stuff. And so even cooler. So the WMAP satellite was the first to enter an orbit around the Lagrange point number 2, right? So the Lagrange point. There are this point. So here in this scheme, you have the sun here, you have the Earth, and there is this Lagrange point number 2, which I'm sure you learn of in classical mechanics. It's basically the point where it's if you sit here, you'll be fixed. It's a point of equilibrium in a sun-Earth system. Okay, and so basically, city, you'll be you will co-rotate with Earth around the sun. And the nice property is, because you have this co-rotation, the nice property about this point is that the distance between this point and the sun is constant over time. Okay, so it means that you have extremely good thermal stability. Okay, which is, of course, what the signal you are trying to measure. You are trying to measure very, very small temperature fluctuation over the sky, like 10 to the minus 5, right? 10 to the minus 6 temperature fluctuation at 2 Kelvin. And so you want your instrument itself to be extremely stable. And one way to do that is to go to this point where you have really an perfect thermal stability. Okay? And that's it. So this orbit is still, so after this kind of classical mechanical problem, nice navigation, and they use the several orbits around the Earth, and then they use the moon to make what they call the moon swing by, just to adjust the orbit, and then to launch the satellite on the right orbit, and it takes about two months to reach the point like on point number two. And so I mentioned earlier so it's the first satellite to reach its orbit around L2. And I mentioned earlier the Planck satellite, which was launched May 16, right? So more than months ago. And actually, the Planck satellite is also going to be in orbit around L2. And it's right now, it's about here, just in its journey towards L2. So that's
How big is the Earth region? How big is that region?
Well, it's not
where you can sort of.
But there is not, it's not a region, right? It's a point in space. There is nothing.
So what I mean, it's a region where the potential is flat.
It's an unstable, it's a semi-unstable point, actually. So you have to, it's a saddle point in potential, basically. So I don't know exactly about the curvature of this potential. I know that basically the orbits, because it's unstable, the orbits need to be adjusted every 3 months or so. So you need to, every 3 months, you need to correct to use, yes, there are some little thrust there on your satellite that needs to adjust to stay in orbit around this point. And this the orbit size here, which would answer your question, I forgot. I know that I know that it's fairly stable, but so it means that there's no object here, there's no rocks sitting here waiting, there's nothing, because it's not a stable point, right? So you need to correct. Just if you want to stay here, you need to be active all the time. All right, so that's not exactly true, because the W doesn't see the monopole, but let's imagine from what you to first order, what you would see if you were looking at the CMB sky, you would see, monopole all over the sky. So nothing at all. And it's not in astronomy and astrophysics. It's really non-trivial it's a very unique feature. You always see stars in homogeneous everything. But if you look in millimeter wavelengths, 2 millimeters, you see everywhere it's exactly the same. Okay, so it's very specific. And so this tells you just this fact has actually already very deep consequences. Okay, so and one of them is it's a horizon problem. So if you look at the CMB as a snapshot of the universe at a redshift of 1,000, okay, and if you consider that the universe was homogeneous then, okay, so you can, at a redshift of 1,000, you know how to compute the horizon size at a redshift of 1,000, okay? So basically, given it means what you can compute on the sky, what's the angular size of the horizon? It means that points which are separated by more than this angle haven't been causal contact at the time of recombination. Okay, still recombination. So if you compute this number, it's very, very simple. It's basically 1 degree on the sky. Okay, and so right away you think, wait a minute, you have these extremely homogeneous radiations over all the sky, but you can predict that the point which are greater than 1 degree haven't been in causal contact. Okay, so this is already puzzling, and this of course leads to this is what is called the horizon problem, and so this was one of the big motivation for inflation when inflation was invented in the early 1980s, and basically it means that as you know, like the way to solve the real inflation solve that is basically by assuming that during earlier before recombination there was a time of extremely rapid exponential inflation, so that actually your computation of the horizon then is has to be revised. And points were actually in causal contact and the inverse expanding much quicker. So actually all the points you see on the sky you see in the CMB as it was causally connected. Okay. But already just the monopole does this mean over the sky have already been interactions. Now if you remove the monopole, you will see this, right? And you see there is a huge, so this is in galactic coordinates, it means the galaxy is right in the center here. And so this is like in the galaxy along here, and this is the bright galactic features. But if you remove the dipole, the first thing you see would be a big dipole. And this dipole comes simply from just Doppler effect, the fact that the Earth within the solar system, and then the solar system within the galaxy, and then the galaxy within the, what we call the local groups, are all in motion, right? So you have a big, the whole system is moving in a CMB frame, which leads to this Doppler effect, which leads to this dipole, okay? And so that's a big, that's a second effect, and it's about 30 millikelvin, so it's about 100 times smaller than the monopole, okay? So, but now you see this dipole, and this is interesting to. So there's very little cosmological information in this dipole, but to say it's a very local phenomenon, so there is almost no information at all. So, but you can remove it, but if you try to compare, it's still interesting to compare what you know from the physics of the local group from other probe, for example, galaxy survey, etc., to see if it's. This direction on the amplitude is that what is consistent with what we know independently, and it's actually fairly consistent, right? So the mass distribution you can infer from this is consistent with what you see if you look at the sky, if you look at the Andromeda galaxy, etc. Okay, so this makes sense. And then if you remove the monopole, you remove the dipole, that's what you observe, okay? In galactic coordinates, and here, this bright emission here is a galaxy, okay? And everything else above the galaxy plane, so here, everything, the rest is CMB and is CMB anisotropy, okay? So what you want to do, the problem is that you're observing, even though you're in space, you know, you're observing through the galaxy, and so galaxies, there are all kind of physics you're not interested in, there's a lot of hot gas, there's dust, etc., which will emit the magnetic field, which will cause synchrotron emission. So this will create a lot of emissions, which will pollute your CMB signal, which appear at the background. And so the way you control that is all the galactic emission is called foregrounds. And the way you control foregrounds is basically by observing the CMB at various frequencies. And for example, here's five frequencies, the WMF5 uses five frequencies ranging from 23 GHz to 90 GHz. And basically, the good thing about galactic foreground is that you know the spectral properties. So by combining this map, making use of the information, for example, you know the spectrum of synchrotron, you know the spectrum of dust to some extent, you know the spectrum of free emission. So by combining literally those maps, you're able to clean most of the galactic foregrounds, and you're able to probe to generate almost full sky map of the CMB. Okay, and it's a very important test of systematic. So you have to be careful when you do that. And once you remove the foreground, you're able to produce this map, which is basically if you want to write in a newspaper, you see that this is a snapshot of the universe when it was 380,000 years old, which is pretty cool. So several features, you see that there's a lot of clumping, okay, in this map, and basically there is a right away, I mean, you don't have to be an expert imaginalist to know that you see a characteristic scale here, right? You see the clumps seem to have more or less all the same size, okay? And this size, the size of these spots here, it's more or less, on average, it's about 1 degree, okay? So if you look at you see clearly many spots of this size, you don't see many smaller ones, you don't see many bigger ones, right? So there is a characteristic there is a characteristic scale in SGNB, and it's about 1 degree. Okay. So how do we understand that? Yes.
Is there something about the southern pole?
Yes. Well, there is several things called southern pole. Well, there's a southern pole on Earth. There is a southern
pole.
Pole. So there's a southern pole. I'm not sure. There's a cold spot. I thought you meant so there's various so people are talking about the south galactic pole, which would be in this coordinate with this point here. There's also the south ecliptic pole, where if you are in ecliptic coordinates. And there's also this point here, which is like called the cold spot, maybe that's what you're talking about. So it just so there's a lot of debate about this area here, whether it's too cold to match CMB predictions. So if you do the proper stuff, if you do careful scale analysis, let's say you count number of hotspots, number of cold spots, compared to what you expect from certain predictions, and some people argue that actually this region here is anomalous. So in which case it would be a sign that, for example, something is wrong in the model or something is missing in the model. So there's all kinds of interpretation. Some people here are actually working on that. And some people see in this part here a sign of, brain interaction of this kind of thing. So there's wide surgical speculations, and there are also wide statistical speculations. You have to be careful. That's what you meant?
Or? So I just heard the term
sort of okay. And there's also a south. Okay, there's also a southern pole, which people use, for example, for SPT or CMB or the CMB polarization survey, which is the fact in the south hemisphere there's an area where you have less galactic foreground, so it's what we call a clean patch. So it's very good if you want to do measure polarization. It's an area where, because of the particular configuration of the galaxy, like there's less foreground. That's what you have to do. Okay. All right, so okay, so naturally, if you look at this map, you see characteristic scale, and so if you try to quantify that, the way to do that, and we talked about that already, is to basically to look at the power spectrum. The power spectrum, you can see it basically as the angular power spectrum, so it's 2D as a function of scale, large scale, small scale, and it's basically quantified the variance of the function of scale. And the fact that you have a characteristic scale in this map will appear in the first peak here. So you have an excess of power at 1 degree scale, which really corresponds to the first peak. Okay? So those are kind of statistics, and we discussed that already yesterday a little bit. And so just a tiny bit of formalism. So the way it is done, the way you quantify that is basically you take the map, you take the CMB temperature map, you remove the monopole, that's what you call them, temperature and isotropies. So we talk about temperature here, but basically temperature, it's just directly related to intensity. So what we're doing is really an intensity map of the CMB millimeter wavelengths. One with the units we use are temperature units. And basically, variation of temperature are a few hundred microkelvin. So it's a very extreme, very accurate measurement of CMB. And so what you do is that you do a spherical harmonic transform, which is like a Fourier transform of the sphere. You get the ALM, which is like the equivalent of the Fourier mode. And the angular power spectrum CL is just the average of ALMs over all M for given L. Okay? That's a basic feature. And now if you want to understand qualitatively at least the features you see in this angular power spectra, it's interesting to consider there are three regions of interest, basically. So first one, there's acoustic oscillations, which we discussed yesterday, okay? And this is basically the feature starting at 1 degree and higher up. Then you see a kind of large-scale plateau, and then you see damping tail. So you see that if you have the perfect acoustic oscillator, you will see, you will see the modes going all the way to your instrumental resolution. But if you don't see that, you see a damping, and there's a reason for that. So another scale of interest is basically it's basically the scale of the horizon, the scale of the horizon at the time of recombination, which I told you is about 1 degree, so it's about here. So it means that all the points, it's a scale of the sun horizon, let's say, at the time of recombination, which is obviously here. Basically, that means all the points which are separated by more than these angular scales, so which is all the points around here, are basically almost unprocessed. I don't mean the acoustic phenomena, I couldn't reach them, so they are almost unprocessed remnant of earlier time, okay? And so those are basically directly proportional to large scale, very large scale fluctuation in your potential, which come directly from inflation, okay? And so this is like what we call the Sachs-Wolfe plateau, and basically the delta temperature, the temperature fluctuation are basically proportional to the potential over one third of the potential. Okay, so you are basically tracing directly the power and your potential here on large scales. On smaller scales, we have this acoustic phenomena we talked about yesterday, and then you have some damping tails. And this damping damps come from the fact it can be understood qualitatively, and it's called the silk damping for George Silk, who invented it. And basically, it comes from the fact that the recombination is not instantaneous, right? It won't happen just like that in redshift space or in time. It has a finite, it will happen over a certain amount of time, so it has some thickness to it, right? And so, and basically, it means that it means that all the modes which are smaller than the thickness of this recombination time will be, you will have extra diffusion during this time and will erase the power, which will erase the temperature fluctuation. So basically, because of this scattering over the remnant of the scattering of over the remnant of the ionized matter during this recombination time, you will lose information of all the scales which are smaller than the projection of this angular scale, of this thickness scale. That makes sense, you know? So and this is basically, this scale here is really an exponential damping, and it's called a silk damping. And it's really just, you know, just because you have rescattering during recombination, you lose information on scale which are smaller than the projected scale. Now, if you look at, the detailed physics is actually, you know, it's not a lot of subtle issues, but basically the physics, you know, it's like the basic physics come from the basically photobaryonic plasma oscillating in the in a dark matter potential wheel. So it's like a driven oscillation, and the drive comes from the dark matter. Okay, and so by looking at the detail of this of the modeling, you can actually learn a great deal about, you are sensitive to various specific parameters, most notably so the baryonic fraction, dark matter, so neutrino content of the universe, Kosmiller constant equation of state, H naught, the amplitude, so sigma 8, and then the slope of the initial power spectra, so that comes directly from inflation, and you're also sensitive to the randomization of the universe and other effects that I want to discuss. So just to illustrate it, if you take those out, no, surgical models, if you look at the power spectra, you normalize in large scales and you vary the baryon density only, you see this kind of feature here. Okay? And so for example, you see that when you increase the baryon density, you increase the first peak, you increase the third peak and the fourth peak, but you decrease the second peak. Okay? So the first peak and third peak will increase with omega baryon, and the one and third peak will decrease. And if you remember this interpretation of the peaks in terms of, so this peak is basically a rarefaction peak, and this is a compression peak, rarefaction, compression. And basically, what's happening is that if you do an analogy with an oscillator, when you change the baryon content, you are changing the loading of your oscillator, and it's a bit like you have a spring with a mass, you have an oscillating spring with a mass, and if you change the mass, if you change the baryon content, you will change the zero point, and you will make the compression part, the lowest point, will vary greatly, but the other part will vary less, right? And this is what you basically see here with this rarefaction peak. If you decrease matter, if you increase now the matter density qualitatively, you see that the amplitude of this time the amplitude of matter of the spectra decrease when you increase omega matter. Okay, so for a given edge, and I will come back to that later. So right, so the structure of CMB comes from the oscillations of the Bunsen fluid, and as we said before, like the exact location in angular space of the peaks will come from the global geometry of the universe, so the angular diameter distance. Now, if you schematically look at the oscillation of this photobaryonic fluid, and the strength here is come from the loading will come from baryons, the potential will come from dark matter, and this force here will come from the radiative pressure. Okay, so and the more baryons you have, the deeper will be, the stronger will be this oscillation. And so you will change the loading this way. So it's a bit qualitative, but you have to go through the equations just to get a feeling of it in details. But and so if you know for the largest scale, the largest mode, it basically the first peak will be is the scale of the first peak will be defined by the mode which has the time to compress only one. Okay, so and if you work out the physics, you know the sound speed, you can actually predict if you know the sound speed and you know the time of recombination, you can predict actually what the size of this perturbation should be, and it's basically 200 megaparsec, okay, which is roughly the same size as the baryonic oscillation we talk about. And if you project over the sky, it's about 1 degree, okay. And so this corresponds to a mode which has the time to compress only once. And this will be a mode, this peak pair will be a mode which I plan to compress once, expand again, and recompress another time, etc. Okay. And this will be a mode, for example, which I plan to compress once, expand again, and that's why you see it, and then etc. So it's really an harmonic series. Okay, let's skip that. Now, if you change the overall, for a given baryon content, a given matter content, if you change the overall geometry of the universe, you will change the way, you will change the angular scale of the peaks. And for example, if you vary the matter density, and if you vary if you introduce some cosmic constant or not, you see for example the peak position which shifts greatly. Okay, and so for example, both models here have the total density of 1, this one has a total density of 0.1, and you see there is a great shift in terms of the peak position. And so the power from the CMB, so the power of the CMB comes from the fact that actually all the effects are linear, so we know how to compute them exactly. And so by comparing observations to models, we're able to infer detailed information, quantitative information about the values each of these parameters. Okay.
Shifting peaks is only for the red peak, only the red.
Yes, okay, yes. It's just a geometry. And so if you look, I was looking, you know, on you again, if you all the sticks, if you look at linear scale, so they really are evenly separated, which really, you know, sign of, you know, acoustic phenomena. So if you work a little more about the details of phenomenology, if you care about the details of phenomenology of the CMB, so this plot will show you that it's actually a subtle, and there are a lot of subtle effects you have, you know, you have to worry about. And you have to, and you see, for example, that when you vary, basically you have four key parameters here, which are like the total curvature, lambda, matter energy, and burn energy. And as you vary them, you know, you have these various effects that you have to take into account. One would be the peak position, and then the amplitude of the vary with omega mh squared, etc. And you have to as W effect or integrated spectral effect, Doppler effect, etc. So it's a bit messy, but we know how to do it. Another effect which is important is actually the fact that your it's a Saxwolf effect, okay, which is relevant on large scale. And so I told you, like, on large scales, the photon distribution will tend to follow the dark matter, the potential will be created by dark matter. And when the photons we observe that come out of dark matter potential will be redshifted. And so, so because of this effect, like you actually deep potential will create, you will observe them as a cold spot. But if you do the full treatment, you observe that on that scale, temperature variation are about 1/3 of the potential will. Okay, just, and so it means that on large scale, you trace directly the variation of the potential wheel, okay, which is called the Saxwolf effect. And these are also an interesting effect at lower redshifts, because I told you, so one effect of the dark energy on at smaller redshifts is basically the fact that it will affect the growth of structure, okay, and basically on larger scale, because the so you have two principles at work. One is a gravitational collapse structure, so which goes faster and faster as, you know, the structure goes more linear. On the other hand, if you introduce dark energy, you will tend to accelerate the expansion of the universe. So the acceleration of this expansion will tend to oppose this collapse of structure. And so basically, it means that you will gravitational potential will be affected by the presence and the amplitude of dark energy on larger scale. And so, for example, if you look at a photon going through a large, so it's a very schematic view, if you look at a photon that goes through a potential well, if you go, you know, it goes down the potential well, you get blue shifted, it goes up, you get red shifted. If the potential well is static, then the blue shift does balance the red shift, so you don't see anything. On the other hand, if the potential evolves in a as a significant evolution in the time scale for relevant for the photon to go through this potential, you actually will see a net redshift, so a net variation in temperature. And for example, if you have dark energy on the larger scale, it will affect the growth of structure, so that you will on the larger scale you will get more blue shift than you get red shift. Okay? And this effect is called the late integrated Saxwolf effect. And it's actually, so you can measure it in a way which I won't detail. And so, and this is late integrated Saxwolf effect is what dominates the CMB. Well, it's an important contribution to the CMB on the larger scales. And why the larger scale is basically because it becomes relevant on a scale which enters the horizon after dark energy started to dominate, right? So dark energy started to dominate the evolution of the universe at a redshift of 1.5 or 2. And so all the modes which enter the horizon later than this, so which are large scale modes, will be affected by the presence of dark energy, and they appear on the large scale. Yeah. And the key point here is that black points are measurements with error bars. You see the extremely small error bars. You see that we have a very good fit to this data. And so by, you know, by translating this good fit in terms of parameter constraint, you're able to infer a very exquisite constraint on the very parameter. So that this CMB is probably the most powerful cosmological probe today. Okay, so oops. I'll skip polarization. Mentioned Planck, so I'll finish with that because it's happening now. So the Planck was launched like a month ago, and so far it's working well. And so just to give you a feeling of what you can expect from Planck, so in the coming, let's say, data collection will start in a month, so you give 2 years of survey and 2 years of analysis, so that's 4 years from now. This is where WMAP will be in 3 years, you know, so very good model. But, you know, at some point, the resolution instrument is limited. So at some point, like, let's say, L of 1,000 or more, error bars start to blow up. And this is what Planck should be able to achieve, right? So it's you can expect much, much more exquisite constraint coming from the CMB in the coming 2 years. Once I mentioned temperature, and I will just mention that because you need to know about it. And it's the CMB, so the CMB, I've talked about temperature fluctuation so far, but it turned out that the CMB is also linearly polarized. So the polarization fraction is fairly small, so it's about, you know, 10%. So it means that you need to, if you are able to measure temperature fluctuation, you want to measure the CMB polarization, you need to be 10 times more sensitive, okay? Or actually 100 times in power. So it's a much more challenging measurement, much more difficult measurement, but the reward for this measurement are huge because basically if you look at the polarization pattern, so it's very much like the shear pattern I showed you over the sky. So it's a field with a without, you know, it's like a vectors without arrows. And you can decompose them as you were decomposing the shear field into magnification as we were decomposing the lensing distortion field into magnification and shear, you can decompose the CMB polarization field into like a curl-free mode, which we call E mode, like the electric field on a curl mode, which is called the B mode, okay, which might would be the equivalent of shear. And the remarkable fact, so E mode, so if you know that if you have perturbations, if you do a full GR pattern of perturbation theory, you can have tensor scalar modes, vector modes, tensor modes, and you can show that actually scalar modes reproduce only E modes. Okay, vector modes are negligible in cosmology, most models because they are decaying, but so and on the other hand, tensor modes, which correspond to gravity waves, they will produce B modes and E modes. Okay, and so. It means that if you observe B modes, it means that only gravity waves can produce B modes. Okay, so so it makes CMB polarization an extremely interesting probe because it could be an equivalent, an ambiguous, very clean probe of indirect probe of gravity waves. Okay, and as we heard from Alessandra yesterday, it's actually the amplitude of the B mode you would observe in the CMB is directly proportional to the energy scale of inflation. Okay, so like one of our 1/4 power. So that if you are able to see B mode polarization in CMB, you will be able to nail down exactly the scale of inflation. So which makes, and it will be a very unambiguous signature because we know only inflation so far could produce such a large scale B mode polarization pattern. So only the inflation can produce a background of gravity wave fluctuation at the relevant frequencies. But of course, it's a very, just to give you feeling, this is a TT signal, temperature signal. This will be like the scalar, you know, scalar induced EE, Van curl free, let's say EE. Polarization in amplitude, so you see you have three order of magnitude different or more, four order, and this would be like a, this would be predicted BB signal, okay? And you see that there's, in terms of sensitivity, there's a huge difference, so you really need to, to improve greatly on sensitivity to be able to measure this experiment. And, you know, and it's, when you think about it, COVID, this was in 92, so 15 years ago, that's where we were measuring. We were happy to discover TT, which was just measuring this part. Now, with the only map, we measured everything up to here. We were a little bit of EE. Planck will go all the way here. And now there are next generation of experiments, biceps and spider, will be able actually to measure the polarization and hope to learn something about inflation, okay, and about basically gravity waves. Okay, and I have stopped here. Sorry. That's not the best concluding slide. All right. Why not? All right, I'll finish with this part.